Hi, I'm Sean. I've always had a passion for personal growth and a curiosity for life's profound questions. I created this show as a platform dedicated to inspiring change through thoughtful and insightful conversation. There's a lot happening in our world today. Some of it clear, some of it confusing. My goal with these conversations is to leave you feeling better and more informed about the state of our world in these challenging times. I'd like to invite you to think outside the lines. Hello, beautiful people, and thank you so very much for joining me today. I'm incredibly excited for you to meet my guest. He's a Silicon Valley-based entrepreneur, investor, and policy advisor. He's also the author of Containing Big Tech, How to Protect Our Civil Rights, Economy, and Democracy. He was the founder and CEO of Centrify, a leading cybersecurity cloud provider that amassed over 2,000 enterprise customers, including over 60% of the Fortune 50. He's been named by Ernst & Young as finalist for Entrepreneur of the Year in Northern California. He's also an active Silicon Valley angel investor with seed investments in over a dozen tech startups with a focus on privacy and cybersecurity. This was an incredibly insightful conversation about the current state of big tech, data privacy, and includes some practical tips for staying vigilant in these areas. It's time to think outside the lines with Tom Kemp. Tom Kemp, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Sean.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to chat with you. We've got some incredibly, I think, timely and relevant topics to discuss today. Now, your forthcoming book is titled Containing Big Tech, How to Protect Our Civil Rights, Economy, and Democracy. And I don't typically dive into a discussion about my guest book at the top of the interview, but I feel like there's so much to unpack with a title like that. And candidly, I think it covers so many topics that I'm passionate about right now. So I thought it would be a great introduction to have you tell us why this title, why these topics, and what aspects of your background led you to write a book that covers so many, you know, bold and polarizing, quite frankly, topics in 2023.
Look, we're obviously in the digital age, and there are five big tech companies, Meta, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, that, you know, have built really innovative products that improve many aspects of our lives. But their intrusiveness and our dependence on them have created some pressing threats to our civil rights, economy, and democracy. And so what I wanted to do is take a look at not only the good stuff about them, but the threats. And the threats include the over-collection and weaponization of our data, the ways that they use AI that sometimes can be problematic, and the fact that these companies are, in effect, large monopolies. And being in Silicon Valley, where the home of startups, that this may not necessarily be a good thing for innovation. So with this book, I wanted to take my background of being in Silicon Valley, starting companies. I also have a background doing public policy. And I wanted to expose the consequences of big tech's digital surveillance, their exploitive use of AI, and their monopolistic and anti-competitive practices. But I just didn't want to list all these problems. I actually wanted to provide solutions as well. And in the end, I want us to be in a place where our civil rights are respected, our economy is competitive, and our democracy is healthy and protected.
So I actually took a break from doing the show during the pandemic, mostly because I just needed to kind of recalibrate with everything going on in the world. And quite honestly, there just seemed to be so much despair in the world. And I didn't really know how to reconcile anything that was happening myself, let alone talk about it on a podcast. And I knew that if and when I did come back and was given a platform, I wanted to use it to engage in, you know, thoughtful, substantive topics like you've written about in this book, quite frankly. And so I'm really grateful to be having this conversation with you. And I think, you know, I obviously have a ton of questions. I'll try to get through as many as possible. I obviously want to dive further into some of the topics that you cover in the book, but I also want to back up a little bit because you, as you alluded to, you are incredibly accomplished. And I'm particularly curious about your entrepreneurial endeavors. What led you down that path initially? And what advice do you have for someone who might want to follow a similar path?
Yeah, no, I grew up in Michigan. I went to the University of Michigan, and I saw Silicon Valley as a place where things could happen, that you didn't have to wear a suit. You didn't have to kind of wait your turn, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years and work your way up the ladder. That if you had a good idea and you had the right spirit and you could be judged based on, you know, who you are versus other factors that, and if you work hard, that you can make a difference. And so I moved out to California. I got my first job at Oracle, which at the time wasn't that big of a company, and then started joining different startups and really caught the entrepreneurial bug. And so I'm really pleased that that kind of satisfied my needs to build something and try to make a difference. And one of the companies that I co-founded went public, and the last one that I was the founder and CEO of was acquired. And there was a lot of benefit that was gained with the employees, the shareholders, et cetera. And so I'm now in a kind of a fortunate situation where I can give back. And so I've been doing angel investing, you know, giving small amounts of money to entrepreneurs, but spending a lot of time mentoring the CEOs who are oftentimes, you know, first-time entrepreneurs and try to give back. And then I've also been spending time doing policy, and I've been taking my knowledge of privacy and cybersecurity and not representing, I'm not a lobbyist or anything like that. I don't work for a big tech firm, and trying to help make a difference right there. And so I worked in 2020 in California on this thing called Proposition 24 that gave California the most robust privacy law in the nation. And then most recently, I co-authored a bill that my local state senator took on board, Senate Bill 362, called the California Delete Act, that would give consumers more power to have their data deleted that's being held by data brokers. So I basically wanted to just, you know, kind of give back. And one way that I'm trying to give back and try to make a difference is that, and also as a challenge, whether or not I could do this, I started writing this book last year, and it's pretty amazing that I've gotten to the point where it's, you know, now being published, and I'm talking with people such as yourself about it as well. So yeah, I think just, you know, worked hard and was in an environment and just now in a position where, you know, I just want to make sure that leave the world behind, you know, better than when I joined it.
You allude to the notion that you know, your intention has always been to leave the world a better place, right? And to make a difference. And what I find really interesting is that I think most people that, especially people that have like entrepreneurial aspirations, people that go into politics, that is their kind of North Star as they begin their journey. But somewhere along the way, that tends to change and the flame seems to die a little bit. Have you observed that? And why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, especially if you're in Silicon Valley and you work in tech, yeah. But it's not necessarily, I mean, it's in other, you know, parts of the country, it's in other careers that, you know, there's a lot of people that are just passionate about their jobs or they want to do well, they're competitive. And if you do it for 10, 20, 30 years, you know, it takes a toll, you get burned out. And you just, I'm kind of the kind of person that just doesn't want to, and I'm too young to retire, but I just don't want to, like, you know, hang my proverbial cleats. I want to be in a situation where I can kind of reinvent myself, right? And so it was, in some sense, I, you know, for the first 20 plus years of my career, I was a tech entrepreneur. And, you know, I said, look, I bet I can take my skills and do public policy and be a thought leader and take what I've learned in those 20 plus years and you know, educate others, while at the same time, you know, other people that are going through the entrepreneurial journey just going back. So I think, you know, people get burned out and they lose the fire. And I think the key thing is that, you know, always try to find something that just keeps you motivated, like Fred Flintstone in the morning, that you want to yabba dabba do, and you go to work with your feet, you know, with Fred Flintstone, you know, moving the car and all that stuff. And so you always want to be in that kind of situation where your batteries are charged and you look forward to the day and there's things that are accomplished and you want to do things that have meaning. And when I was an entrepreneur, for me, the meaning was to create jobs and generate a solid return for my investors and my employees who betted on me. You know, my motivation when I do angel investing is to really help mentor the next generation of entrepreneurs so they can achieve their goals and their dreams, et cetera. And, you know, what I'm trying to do as a policy advisor is just take my knowledge and, you know, try to protect consumers, especially from a privacy perspective as well. So I think it's just, I think it boils down to, you know, just trying to find things that charge your batteries and make you want to keep on doing more work. And I think that's the key thing. And people do get tired or burned out. And I think it's good that people should try to look to reinvent themselves in some way.
Definitely. Now, your background, as you mentioned, is in tech and cybersecurity, and I know that you've been involved in some, heavily involved in some rather significant privacy legislation, which I do want to talk about, and particularly in California. I want to dive deeper into the topic of privacy, because the thing that I find fascinating, having grown up in, you know, the 80s, 90s, when technology seemed to develop at what felt like a much slower pace than it does today, I feel like I came of age before technology was something that just kind of existed in the background of our lives, if that makes sense. It didn't feel like something that I was immersed in 24/7. And I mean that literally, because I literally wear a ring to bed that tracks my sleep today. And now technology is just like this, you know, ubiquitous part of our lives that in a way it feels like it just fades into the background. And I don't think that people necessarily give much thought to things like privacy, data, and the true impact that these things have on our lives, right? In both the short and long term. And I think that's particularly because, you know, it feels like it's happening so quickly and essentially invisibly. And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit, you know, specifically some key points that people should be more mindful of in that realm.
Yeah, look, in the past, the technology companies focused on building products and selling those products to either businesses or consumers. But first with Google, then Meta, the focus shifted to providing free offerings, and in exchange for those free offerings, they were able to collect data, which then they served ads. And that was a great trade-off in that you got, you know, free email, free social network, et cetera. And yeah, so sometimes you got these creepy ads that, you know, you type the word Porsche or Ferrari or something like that, and then in a chat session, and then all of a sudden you start seeing ads for that car, you know, like literally hours later, and the ads would show up on every website. And that was a little spooky or weird or whatever, but okay, fine, whatevs, right? But the problem is that over the last few years, and it first started happening in 2016, is that this data that's being used, and frankly, just flat out, you know, your data is being over-collected, it's now starting to be weaponized against us. And the weaponization occurred in 2016 to help manipulate people, and nation states like Russia use that information to try to push people in certain directions. And then at the same time, what we found is that if you use that data as an advertiser, for example, to target young women with children, young children, say sell them diapers, that same advertising construct could be used to exclude young women with children from, say, housing ads, et cetera. And so it could be used to discriminate against people. And then finally, with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, with the Dobbs decision, that the data that's collected about reproductive health or someone trying to seek an abortion or getting directions on Google Maps to an abortion clinic can actually be weaponized against people. And for example, there's now a law in Idaho that it's illegal to get an out-of-state abortion. And there's a law in Texas that, you know, people can basically, you know, sue people if they got an abortion, et cetera. And so this data now can be weaponized against people. It can be weaponized from an identity theft perspective if you're seeking reproductive health, et cetera. And kind of the way things are going with the negativity towards trans and LGBTQ people, you know, maybe the data that's collected about people that identify with that, you know, could also be used from a discrimination or from a harassment or a doxing perspective, et cetera. So unfortunately, you know, we do not have a federal privacy law. And so we don't have rights to necessarily know what's being collected. We don't have rights to say no to the sale of our data, et cetera. And so, you know, this data now has kind of a double-edged sword. And I really don't think that we have the proper guardrails in place to ensure that our most sensitive data is not being used against us or children, right? You know, is it really good and healthy in society to have kids completely being tracked? If it happened in the physical world, the person would be a stalker, right? And when you're a kid, you're trying to figure out who you are, and you're using technology to do searches and trying to find out who your friends are and where you fit and all that stuff. And you're going to change your tact and where you go and what you think, et cetera, as part of this exploration. And I don't think it's necessarily good or healthy to have, as you go through this exploration process, and you and I probably have gone through exploration processes in our adulthood, and it's just not, it's not good to basically kind of be in a big brother type situation where all this information is being collected about you, and advertisers and tech companies know more about you than maybe your family or friends do. And so that's kind of the fundamental issues that we're, and challenges that we're facing.
Yeah. And I think there's obviously a lot to unpack there. And I do want to talk about some of the legislation, like I said, but I also, I actually want to unpack some of like the nuance that you alluded to, right? Because there is obviously, like, to your point, you know, you type in Porsche or BMW and you see an ad. You said hours later. I think it's come down to seconds later.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And I think that, you know, we could talk about, like, you know, cookies and pixel tracking and all kinds of other stuff that, you know, the technical aspect behind, you know, how that happens. But I think it's one thing if you're trying to sell me a car. It's another thing if I'm a depressed teenage girl that, you know, is scrolling through Instagram. And I know that there's, you know, you say things can be weaponized. I think that there's been, you know, whistleblowers for things like Facebook that said that it was actually like they were showing teenage girls that were depressed things that would make them even more depressed.
Because, right? the motivation is, yeah, let me just jump in here, because the motivation for a lot of these tech companies is to keep people on the proverbial screens so they can be served more ads. And yeah. So what happens is the algorithms, the artificial intelligence says, oh, someone's interested in this, so let's serve more ads. And in fact, Wall Street Journal 2 years ago found that when they set up some accounts that were what they said were teen accounts, et cetera, you know, within days they were being served videos regarding drug use, pornography, alcohol use, et cetera. And it quickly just kind of spirals into rabbit holes. They don't necessarily have the best interest in mind. Now, you and I can probably navigate out of these rabbit holes when we start seeing videos, et cetera, or like, wait, whoa, this is crazy. But, you know, kids don't have that capability, and they can be heavily influenced. And I fundamentally believe that this behavioral or surveillance advertising should be banned for kids, that they know, and not necessarily having the kids have to show an ID to get onto the internet, but you can probably pretty easily, the tech companies can figure out if this is likely a child. Similarly, the use of sensitive data should not also be exploited for advertising. So anything that you do from a healthcare perspective, anything involving ethnicity, sexuality, et cetera, you know, should not be, that type of data should not be utilized. It's okay, yeah, if you type the word car or BMW or Porsche or whatever, and to your point, maybe it's seconds later. But if you are typing information about cancer treatment or Adderall or HIV testing, et cetera, then that should not be available to have ads being, you know, sent your way, or people now have you on that profile or list of someone that has cancer. And that can be used eventually to discriminate against you. So, yeah, there should be guardrails that are put up here.
Yeah. And a lot of people I've talked to have suggested that, you know, social media in particular is akin to, you know, its addictive qualities are akin to that of like nicotine or alcohol. And if you, you know, make someone show an ID to purchase either of those things or to use those things, why would you not do that for something like social media that's potentially just as, if not more dangerous?
Well, TikTok, I mean, gosh, look at TikTok. I mean, it's the kids are now, like, the average kid spends like an hour a day on TikTok, right? And the average video length is, what, 20 seconds or something like that? So you can kind of do the math of the kids are getting this dopamine hit, you know, for an hour, and it's all on autoplay, right? That's a great example of, you know, the need to actually get tech companies to design their products with kids in mind, right? There should be like a stop button, or, you know, you've been using this for too long. But again, their general interest, who they serve is their shareholders, and to serve the shareholders, they serve their advertisers. And so it's about, you know, just trying to get people to stay on, and things kind of, as you pointed out, like, the Meta/Facebook people knew that Instagram, you know, was unhealthy for, especially for teen girls, et cetera. And they need to do more, because it can lead to unhealthy behavior, especially for the most vulnerable in our society.
Yeah. And you mentioned like the time limits. You can actually set those, right? But I look at those similar to how I look at a snooze button in the morning, where it pops up on the screen and I can just, you know, tap it away. So ultimately, that's not very helpful, right? You also mentioned that you and I, if we're spiraling down a rabbit hole on social media, we probably have the wherewithal to stop, you know, redirect or something along those lines. But there, especially in America, there's a significant amount of people who don't and have been lost to that rabbit hole. I know some of them personally. How does disinformation play into all of this?
I think we all know people. I mean, before, we always had like, you know, at the Thanksgiving dinner, there was, you know, an uncle or someone like that that had strong opinions in one direction or another, and you can kind of laugh it off. And at some point you stop debating. But now if you're just being served this type of information and you're in this information bubbles, it's hard to get people out. And so now we have people, you know, believing in crazy conspiracy theories, but they take it as gospel. And it actually became very difficult. You mentioned earlier in the show, COVID, that, you know, unfortunately people believed certain things and it actually killed them, right? You know, they didn't believe in vaccines, and unfortunately, and then everything, because once they started going down that path of like, hey, I'm not interested or suspect of vaccines, then the algorithm said, oh, this person's watching this, he's listening, this is content that they care about. And it became algorithmic amplification. And so then that's the only thing that became served. And so therefore, you know, these information bubbles, these rabbit holes formed, et cetera. And at the end of the day, you know, the tech platforms, because of Section 230, they're not liable for the user produced content on their platforms. And they're focusing on just trying to keep people so they collect more information and conserve more ads. And it just kind of leads down this path, and it's tough to get out of it. I mean, we know adults that have fallen into these rabbit holes, but what if you're a kid? I mean, and then of course, you know, there has been an increase in teen suicide, unfortunately, and it kind of also kind of parallels the rise of social media. I'm not 100% blaming social media on this, et cetera. There's other factors involved, but I don't think it's helped in this regard. And so, again, it goes to the core motivation and the business models. Unfortunately, the largest tech companies, for the most part, have business models which are focused on over-collecting information, that data to keep people on the platforms, et cetera. So I like to say that, you know, yes, we've had past monopolies like Standard Oil, and they were incredibly powerful, but they didn't know everything about us, right? And that's kind of where things are different from past monopolies that we've had in the U.S. And the reality is that these guys, they really don't face competition, right? They're the market leaders in search and mobile operating systems and social media, et cetera. So if you're an entrepreneur and want to start a company to compete against, you know, Google and search, people look at you as you're crazy. You're not going to get funding for that. And so they're not being pushed to add more consumer privacy-focused features and capabilities, because we're kind of orienting their platforms and there's no alternatives, because there's no interoperability with alternative solutions that if you leave Facebook, you can't communicate with people that are still on Facebook in terms of, you know, the social media, et cetera. So they kind of have a captive audience, and some people say that they've gotten too big to care, you know, to make some of the changes that are needed. And that's why, you know, that people such as myself, you know, need to press them. And I'm not saying they're evil. I'm just simply saying that the way things have spiraled, that it's increasingly there's some unhealthiness that's happening with this technology. And it definitely impacts, you know, children, for example.
Yeah. And you mentioned Section 230. And I'm wondering if maybe you could explain a bit about what that is. And I know there was also a Supreme Court case recently that kind of tried to challenge that and failed.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this Communications Decency Act, and there's a section, it's Section 230. And basically it says that the tech platforms are not liable for the content that's published. And so some privacy organizations have called this the Magna Carta of the internet. And it's good, which means Substack, Twitter, et cetera, that if someone, Facebook, you just go down the whole list, you know, posts something that's, you know, crazy or opinionated in one way or another, that the platforms are not going to be liable. And so that kind of allows, you know, the whole free speech, you know, and the internet, et cetera, to happen. But the issues then become, which is unlike, say, if you're a newspaper and you publish something and you've become the publisher, then you could actually be liable for what is said. But then it gets to the interesting point of, well, wait a minute, if algorithms start amplifying certain content, don't you actually start actually becoming a quote unquote publisher, you know, with content? So that's the first issue. And then what happened most recently with the Supreme Court, that there were a couple cases, and it's really sad that there was a young woman actually from Southern California. She was studying in Paris, and a few years back, groups associated with ISIS did these horrific terrorist attacks, and like 190 people were killed in Paris. And the family sued, and because it turned out that YouTube, which is owned by Google, obviously, you know, was amplifying ISIS content. And in some cases, that ISIS had websites and they were part of the Google ad networks, they were actually collecting revenue. So you could even argue that in an indirect way that Google was actually funding to a small extent ISIS. And the family sued, and this is Gonzalez versus Google. And it was just decided a few months back in the Supreme Court. And in Section 230, people thought maybe it would get modified. But in the end, it did not. It survived intact. My take is that there's ways that you can preserve 230, but you should be able to have the right to be able to flag and object to specific content and have those organizations respond, especially if that content is illegal. And the problem that we have, it's not necessarily with content moderation, it's the inability for content to be flagged and people to actually have to go through a response. And another issue with respect to content is that the big tech companies are shutting off researchers from the flow of information to be able to analyze, to help flag things and improve things, et cetera. So I think there's actually ways that you could go about looking at Section 230 without actually having to throw away 230 and actually improve things. And in fact, some of these things are now showing up in European laws, such as the Digital Services Act, which does require a responsiveness to people flagging specific content that the platform providers have to respond. And I think we should have something like that in the US, that you could still have the open platform, but there should be some responsiveness, especially if the content is illegal, that breaks the law, that they just can't sit there and just ignore it. The platforms do have to respond.
Yeah. And I think it's really fascinating to me, you know, in this realm, that like Fox News, for example, is held to a certain standards with respect to being like a broadcast network, right? And if I go on Fox News and say that, you know, Dominion voting machines rigged the election, I can be sued if they broadcast that, right? And if Tucker Carlson says that to, you know, 2 million people for 6 months, there's you know, a lawsuit that's involved. But if I go on YouTube and say that, I'm just exercising my free speech and there's nothing they can do under this law, right?
Yeah. And I think there should be an opportunity to, especially if like that person, I think his name is Roy Epps or whatever. Yep. That if people started posting that on, and if I was Roy Epps and there was people posting this on YouTube, I should have the right to go to YouTube and say, wait a minute, this is not correct. And they should be able to respond, et cetera. And, you know, there should be the ability to have to flag content and have a responsiveness associated with it. And unfortunately, that's not it. It doesn't stop people from posting. It does provide a level of responsibility associated with the content that is getting posted out there.
Yeah. And I think there's just so much bureaucracy and lobbying that I don't know if that will change on behalf of the content platforms. And I guess for context, Roy Epps he was like a January 6th participant, right? And he was indicted, and Tucker Carlson, I think, went on and basically said that he was like the leader of it.
Well, initially what happened was this guy was, he actually did participate in January 6th, but he actually wasn't initially indicted. And so people were saying, well, there must be a reason that he wasn't indicted. He must have been like, you know, with the government, et cetera. Well, it turns out it just took a while, but they eventually did indict him. I mean, he was on the Capitol, et cetera. But, you know, I don't think he was like, you know, with a pole poking people. And so it turns out that, you know, after all these wild accusations occurred, eventually the government kind of got down to the next level of people and did indict him. And he claims that he's never been associated and affiliated with the government. And he, after these claims occurred with Tucker Carlson and Fox, his lawyers said, hey, this is not true. Please take this down. And they just simply ignored it. And so, yes, the traditional media is liable for this content. And it sounds like this gentleman, you know, hopefully get his day in court. But to your point, if you type this on Twitter, he may not have the ability to, you know, to have Twitter take that down.
Yeah. I think I heard the other day that he has a pretty strong defamation case against Fox, similar to, I mean, probably not quite as much money as Dominion, but it's in that realm.
Oh yeah, no. I think that it's pretty cut and dry that for months they said that, you know, he's absolutely, positively, definitely an FBI agent. And that's pretty easy to disprove. You know, you can haul.
One would think, but today, yeah, with the disinformation, yeah, around us, it's not necessarily.
You never know.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk a little more about the California, because California is doing some big things. And I know you've been involved in some of this legislation. I know in California, there's specifically the CCPA, which is the California Consumer Privacy Act. And then there's this Prop 24. That's the California Privacy Rights Act, the CPRA. What are your thoughts on the effectiveness of this legislation in protecting consumer privacy? And how does it impact, you know, businesses and individuals?
Yeah. So in 2018, the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA, was passed, and it went into force in 2020. And the main person behind it, a gentleman by the name of Alistair McTaggart, he saw, like right after the law passed, that industry was just really trying to water it down. So he decided to upgrade the CCPA with the CPRA, the California Privacy Rights Act, and he knew he couldn't get it through the legislature, so he did a ballot initiative in 2020. It was Prop 24. I actually got to know Alistair, and then I was actually a full-time volunteer on the campaign for about 6 months, and I basically was the chief marketing officer. And the thought process behind the CPRA was that, hey, let's make it a floor versus a ceiling so it can't be watered down. And then the second major thing was that, hey, let's make California privacy law on par with what Europe has with the GDPR, which is their privacy law, the General Data Protection Regulation. And then finally, we need to have some teeth in terms of enforcement. So that's why they set up, as part of Prop 24 and the CPRA, they set up this thing called the California Privacy Protection Agency, which really is the first dedicated privacy agency in the U.S. And when it eventually gets staffed up, we'll have more people working on privacy than the FTC has for the entire nation, which is great. And then last year, the age-appropriate design code was passed. And so, and this year, I'm working on this California Delete Act that would give consumers the ability to delete their information that data brokers have on them as well. So California, you know, has always had the California effect, where it's led the nation in consumer protection. And so, but the reality is it takes time to build out this agency for enforcement. And so they're still ramping up, but at least the law's in place, right? Regulations associated with the law won't be enforced until 2024, but I think we'll start seeing more activity happening right here. And the fundamental goal is of these laws is to give core privacy rights. We don't, the word privacy doesn't show up in the U.S. Constitution. Now, it was added to the California Constitution in, I think, 1972, et cetera. But the idea is consumers should have the right to know what's being collected, and they should have the right to say no to the sale of their data, and that there should be some, you know, safeguards in place that businesses have to protect our sensitive information. And I think that sounds reasonable, that there should be rights that we have in the digital age.
Yeah, and California obviously appears to be leading in this space. What, if anything, are other states doing in this realm? And what, if anything, is going to be done, can be done at this point at the federal
level?
Yeah,
so California, just like, you know, automobile emissions, you know, kind of leads the nation from a consumer protection perspective. And so California was the first to come out with a privacy bill that became a law. And then the good, now fast forward, you know, that was 2018, and now we're in 2023. We now have 10 states, including California, that have passed a privacy law, and two more about to come online. Oregon and Delaware will be added to the mix. Even Texas. Texas became the 10th state to have a privacy law. So now pretty soon we'll have 12 states that have privacy. About, you know, 25% of the U.S. population will fall under a basic privacy law that protects them. But unfortunately, three quarters of the nation doesn't. Now, many businesses will say, geez, it's just going to be easier for us to give everyone in the U.S. the rights that you get with, say, California. And that's, again, the California effect. But the fact that now that we have this patchwork of state laws, you know, is going to put pressure on the federal government to come out with a federal privacy law. And the reality is that we haven't had any major pieces of privacy legislation since the mid-90s with HIPAA for our, you know, our health information, and the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act for financial. And those were very sector specific. And we haven't had a kind of more of a horizontal comprehensive privacy law. So I'm hoping that as more states add this, that finally the federal government, you know, will say, okay, we do need a national privacy law, and potentially, and I think it's even more necessary now that AI is really starting to come to the forefront. And of course, what feeds AI is data, right? And yeah. And so I think that eventually there needs to be regulation. And the issue that we've had with the big tech companies is that they've throughout their whole existence, they've been unregulated, and they have been breaking things and moving fast, right? And, you know, they've obviously built incredible companies, but eventually, sometimes these big companies eventually evolve into monopolies where they may not have the best interest of society or our democracy or economy in mind. And in the past, we've actually gone out and broken up companies. We broke up AT&T. And look what happened. A telecommunications revolution occurred. You know, we got like cheaper international calling plans. Imagine, I don't know if you remember, but Microsoft, when the internet revolution was happening, Microsoft required PC manufacturers that they could only put Internet Explorer as the browser, right?
Yeah.
And the last major antitrust case by the DOJ put pressure on Microsoft, and they said, okay, we're going to allow other browsers. Internet Explorer killed Netscape, right? That's what killed Netscape, was that they just started bundling it with Windows. But once the DOJ said, you can't do that, that opened up the internet revolution. And so then that opened up the door for Google to be able to, you know, come out with their browser, their search engine, et cetera, and really grow. And I think actually, you know, putting some pressure and putting some guardrails would actually be good and healthy, as we've seen in the past when we've done it to AT&T and Microsoft, and we did it in the past to Standard Oil and the big tech railroad robber barons as well.
Yeah. And going back to privacy for just a second, what do you say to people who, you know, I hear all the time, it's the internet, it's 2023. I'm not doing anything wrong online.
Okay. Yeah. I think that is the most common, is like, I have nothing to hide. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So that I've got nothing to hide. Okay. Well, what if you're a woman and you want to get birth control or you want to seek an abortion? Don't you have something to hide, especially when, what, 1/3 of the states in the United States now has banned abortion? That's a big deal, right? Now, or what about, for example, the location tracking, that there was a priest that was outed by a Catholic newspaper because they bought his location data from data brokers and they were able to track him going to gay bars, right? You know, what about potentially people researching and getting data on people that may have transitioned, et cetera? And so there's a lot of, you know, laws regarding people, trans people, LGBTQ people that are being proposed, et cetera. And then there's also stuff that you don't even know about. It turns out that both Google and Facebook, now Meta, were successfully sued because advertisers were using their systems to exclude people from seeing rental ads. So you don't know, you actually, you know, if you were, say, a young African American and you had that attitude of, hey, you know, this is the internet, et cetera, well, it may just so happen that you were not actually able to see specific rentals because people used the system where they used it to target certain types of demographics. You can use it to exclude certain demographics from seeing ads, right? And people use that to discriminate. And there's actually cases, and both Meta and Google got sued and they had to settle and they had to change their systems to do this. And then finally, this wealth of data can actually be used against you from an identity theft perspective. And it's only going to get worse with AI. So the data points are coming in with the weaponization of data in terms of being used for discrimination, to, you know, potentially go after you legally if you seek reproductive rights, to dox you if you change yourself in some form or some manner, et cetera. The reality is that these entities, these organizations, companies know more about you than your friends and family, right? And that information is available via credit card. And at some point, that's not healthy. And then the final thing I'll say is, going back to what we talked about with kids, is that, you know, yeah, kids may not have something to hide, but it's not good, it's not healthy that kids are being tracked 7x24 because they can be manipulated or they can fall into rabbit holes. And we've seen some serious consequences of kids killing themselves because of the imagery and the videos being pushed to them, that they have they develop a negative outlook about themselves, et cetera. So there are some real world consequences that surveillance or behavioral advertising maybe should have some limitations, especially when it comes to our sensitive data, especially when it comes to collecting information about kids.
There is so much to unpack in that.
Yeah.
I could talk about this for the next 12 hours. I want to talk briefly about AI because it's become a really hot topic as of late. What are your thoughts on the ethical implications of AI, which is obviously artificial intelligence, and particularly, I guess, as it pertains to privacy and bias?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we've had AI. I mean, so AI is basically algorithms, but the difference is the algorithms, based on the data being fed into them, can learn, adapt, adjust. And so eventually people are saying that AI can eventually get to, you know, human-like reasoning and decision-making. And so historically, AI has been used for automated decision-making. A lot of the stock trading that occurs on Wall Street, you know, is now AI, and people are not like freaking out about that. They just assume that, like, okay, there's, you know, automated trading that occurs, et cetera. But, you know, what's really raised consciousness is generative AI, where you can do text to images or text to paragraphs, et cetera. And look, you know, there's a lot of good about AI. Like, there are safer cars because of the sensors can recognize if another car is too close, or that's a fire hydrant or a biker, et cetera. Medical, incredible work being done with AI and medical to, you know, find diseases, you know, look at lab results, things of that nature. Obviously, AI with voice recognition, personal assistance, you can go down the whole list. But just like anything in the world, it can be used for negative purposes. And so we have seen examples of, you know, deep fakes, for example, that you know, there's kind of revenge pornography or deep fake pornography that goes after people. There's also kind of a bad use of AI, which is known as dark patterns that trick you to do things. And a great example of that is, like, you sign up for something like, you know, Amazon Prime, and then, okay, now I no longer want to use that. Oh my gosh, just trying to unsubscribe for something. You know, it's like walking into a Roach motel. You can get in, but you can't totally get out, right? And in fact, Amazon is being sued in Norway. And just recently, the FTC is suing Amazon for the use of dark patterns. Interestingly, you know, Amazon used it was like Project Odyssey, right? Which, you know, kind of like this Greek myth of like a journey of 100 years. That's what they called it, you know, which is the way to unsubscribe. So it was kind of damning right there. But the other issue with AI, especially when it comes to big tech, is that they're now trying to leverage AI to really pummel you with more ads, right? And to kind of keep you on board. And probably the apex predator of the use of AI and your personal information is TikTok, right? Where people now say, hey, TikTok knows me better than I know myself, right? And again, that's fine from an entertainment perspective, but it's not necessarily healthy when it comes to kids, where there's that, you know, you really need autoplay that does eventually, you know, that you shouldn't have autoplay with kids. It should stop. There should be some natural breaking points, et cetera. So AI is veering into areas of that, you know, facilitates addiction. It facilitates, you know, tricking people. It facilitates into, you know, going after people in the form of deep fakes, but it also can be used from a bias perspective that people can actually, even though it's illegal to actually, you know, discriminate based on, say, ethnicity or race, et cetera, that AI could actually be used to use proxies for that, like what type of music or what zip code you use, et cetera. And it makes it even more difficult to figure out if you, in fact, are actually being discriminated against as well, when you do get rejected for that loan or you don't get into a college, et cetera. So there does need to be, you know, a lot more industry standards, just like we have industry standards for the financial world. We have certified public accountants. We have certified financial statements. Drugs have to be approved by the FDA. And so stuff like that, especially AI that's involved in personal safety or high risk aspects, you know, probably should go through and get some sort of approval. There probably should be some ISO standards associated with AI. There should be the equivalent of certified public accountants that can analyze AI just like they analyze financial statements, et cetera. So we need more guardrails if AI, you know, is such incredible technology that everyone says it is.
Specifically looking ahead, what do you believe will be the most pressing challenges and opportunities at the intersection of tech, cybersecurity, and democracy?
Wow. So the pressing challenges will be, you know, how can we keep innovation going when we have such concentration of power in, you know, five tech companies? And, you know, it's kind of the things that we talked about before, which is that the big tech companies have incredible products, have done amazing things, et cetera. But when you have too much concentration, it's in the end, it's not healthy. And these companies are also poised to be the leaders in artificial intelligence, because AI relies on computing power and it relies on data. And those are the companies that have the computing power and data. And so then the question then becomes is that do they extend their monopoly positions to artificial intelligence and that we have more economic concentration, et cetera. So I think the biggest challenge is that these companies were the scrappy startups and the darlings of Silicon Valley. And most of them have very favorable ratings from consumers, et cetera. But, you know, we just need to step back and say, is this healthy, you know, for us to have such concentration of power? And then on the hopeful side is, you know, AI is just doing amazing things. And I actually think that AI, you know, will create new industries. It'll destroy some industries. It'll take away some jobs, just like automation has happened in the past, but it'll create new stuff. And yeah, you know, I'm super excited if there can be technology that does a better job of detecting cancer or curing cancer or coming out with new vaccines and it leverages AI. Amazing. Great. Let's go for it, et cetera. But I do think we need to, you know, make sure that there's ethics involved in AI, just like there's, you know, ethics involved in medicine, you know, and really, you know, really try to implement the let's not do evil stuff, right? Because there's been, I think that's more of a slogan for one of the big tech companies as opposed to reality for some of these things. And so I think I'm very optimistic what can be done with AI, but I also think we just need to make sure that we have the proper regulation guardrails in place to ensure that people are not discriminated against and that it doesn't damage our kids.
Well, I do like to end things on a hopeful note.
Yes. So AI is good, but yeah. AI is good, but just like, you know, just like too much ice cream or whatever, it can have some negativity about it. And by the way, I will say that in my book, I just don't want to be a Debbie Downer and bring up the issues. I actually spent a lot of time in the book talking about solutions and what people can do and empowering people and what simple things, relatively simple things that policymakers can do to improve the situation as well. So ironically, like people, and actually I think some of the big tech companies want to make it like, oh, this is a hard problem to crack and this is confusing and let us take care of it. What I'm trying to say actually in the book is I'm quite hopeful that and there are some simple things that can be done. And frankly, we've done this in the past. We did it with the railroads. We did with Microsoft bundling Internet Explorer. We did it with AT&T. And look at the incredible internet revolution that occurred. The telecommunications revolution occurred. And we have the capacity to do it. It first takes awareness. And it takes, you know, kind of thoughtful solutions. And that's what I'm trying to do in my book containing big tech. So I think it's actually kind of a hopeful book in the end.
Well, Tom, this conversation has just been so incredibly insightful, informative. I just want to thank you so much for your time today. And when your book comes out and beyond, I'm extending an invitation for you to come back and continue what I think is a really important conversation sometime. So I'd love for you to tell those listening how they can connect with you and where they can get your book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. So first of all, I do have a website. It's tomkemp.ai, tomkemp.ai. And I have a lot of blog posts and I kind of talk about tech issues, etc. The book, you can go to containingbigtech.com, all one word, and you can order it. It's available in August. So just go ahead and order it. And you can follow me on Twitter at tomkemp00 as well.
All right, I want to thank my guests today for sharing their insight with us, and I'm incredibly grateful to you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this conversation. I hope it left you better and smarter. If you haven't already, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review for the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have an idea for a future guest or a particular topic you'd like me to cover, you can email me directly, hello@thinkoutsidethelines.com. Now may you go out into the world today and leave things better than you found them. For more information, please visit thinkoutsidethelines.com.